The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello again, everybody. This is Friday morning in the United States. It is 6th of August, and I hope it is a very nice, pleasurable summer day for you all. It is certainly not nice and pleasurable in the economy. It has gone from bad to worse. It is, in fact, collapsing literally right in front of our eyes. Millions of Americans have lost their jobs and their homes. Others are trying to hang on any way they can. As more Americans than ever switch over to survival mode, some strange new phenomena are occurring. For example, an increasing number of Americans are now living in their homes with the electricity and water turned off. Yes, that's right. They're camping out in their own homes without any power and without any running water. In the so-called richest nation on earth, millions of Americans can no longer afford electricity and water. Utility shutoffs have been rapidly increasing as more Americans than ever before find themselves simply unable to pay their debts. So this is what the American dream has come to? Sitting in your homes with the water and the power turned off? Houses everywhere are going vacant. People don't say goodbye. They don't leave a number. They just disappear. With their disappearance, we add another vacant house to the street. But families living in housing without utilities is a new sight for people to behold. There was a rep who from South SoCal Edison recently who had some full-time contact residents who have had their electricity turned off due to non-payment. She has a negotiator sent in, and they work on a reduced payment. It's amazing that now it's become acceptable in California to camp out in your home. People are losing their homes, losing their cars, and losing their dignity. How are we going to afford kids' clothes and school supplies for the coming year? How can we expect families to pay for all these additional costs when the economy is in the shape it's in? Light switches, furnaces and water faucets aren't the typical gauges of economic health, but at Pikes Peak United Way's 211 call center, they tell a tale of people who continue to struggle to pay their bills in a weak economy. According to a report released Monday by the 211 Information and Referral Hotline, requests for utility bill assistance in the fiscal year ending June the 30th jumped 20% from the previous year, outstripping requests for help with food and rent. Quote, that's by far the biggest spike in looking at data year to year, according to 211 Center Manager Jessica Johnson-Simmons. I would guess it would have something to do with the recent utility hikes that have gone into effect. It's also a case of clients just getting too overwhelmed. As the recession continues, utility companies say a growing number of New Jerseyans are falling behind on their electric, gas, and water bills. For many, a flood of emergency funding in state and federal aid programs, coupled with a state-imposed moratorium on utility shutoffs during the winter months, has helped keep the lights on and the water flowing over the last few months. But with much of the state money gone and the winter moratorium ended, utility officials say more and more families may be losing their electricity, gas, or water service in the coming months. PSE&G, the state's largest utility, has seen a 10% increase in families behind on their payments. compared with this time last year. Many of those are households that had never had a late payment until now. Well, last Friday, the Commerce Department reported that GDP had slipped from 3.7% to 2.4% in one quarter. Now that depleted stockpiles have been rebuilt and fiscal stimulus is running out, activity will continue to sputter, increasing the likelihood of double-dip recession. Consumer credit and spending have taken a sharp downturn, and data released on Tuesday show that the personal savings rate has soared to 6.4%. Mushrooming savings indicate that household deleveraging is ongoing, which will reduce spending and further exacerbate the second-half slowdown. The job situation is equally grim. 8 million jobs have been lost since the beginning of the recession. Long-term so-called structural unemployment is here to stay. The stock market has continued its high wire act due to corporate earnings reports that surprised to the upside. 75% of S&P companies beat analysts' estimates, which helped send shares higher on low volume. Corporate profits increased, but revenues fell. Companies laid off workers and trimmed expenses to fatten the bottom line. Profitability has been maintained even though the overall size of the pie has shrunk. Stocks rallied on what is essentially bad news. And according to ABC News, and I quote, consumer confidence matched its low for the year this week, with the ABC News Consumer Comfort Index extending a steep 9.6-week drop from what had been its 2010 high. The weekly index, based on Americans' views of the national economy, the buying climate, and their personal finances, stands at a minus 50 on its scale of plus 100 to minus 100, just 4 points from its lowest on record in nearly 25 years of weekly polls. It's in effect the death zone for consumer sentiment. End of quote. Consumer confidence has plunged due to persistent high unemployment, flatlining personal incomes, and falling home prices. Ordinary working care about jobs, wages, and providing for their families. This is from the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, the lackluster job market continued to weigh on confidence. The share of consumers who expected the job market to improve in the next 6 months fell to 14.3% in July, the second straight monthly drop and the lowest reading since March. Views of business conditions also worsened. The share of people who expected conditions to improve over the next half year fell to 15.9% in July, the lowest since April 2009. End of quote. Home prices rise, but outlook for sector dim. Connor Doherty, Wall Street Journal. Nobody believes that the U.S. is the land of opportunity anymore, or that their children will have a better life than they did. As the slump deepens, pessimism will turn to desperation, higher crime, and social unrest. Everyone pays for long-term unemployment. Factory orders, household purchases, and personal consumption expenditures are all in the dumps. New mortgage applications and home sales have plummeted to historic lows. Housing prices are expected to follow the downward trend in sales. Still, the stock market lunges upward in fits and starts, utterly disconnected from the underlying real economy, where personal balance sheets are in a shambles and where six applicants battle for every new job opening. This is from Naked Capitalism, and I quote, Wells Fargo Gallup survey of 604 small business owners conducted in early July showed a plunge in already negative readings to new lows. This gloomy outlook matters because small businesses were the biggest source in job creation in the last upturn and are expected again to be the main source of hiring. Small business owners expect things to get worse. The main reason for the decline in the index was the decay in the future expectations sub-index, which is the first time business owners as a whole have been negative about their company's prospects for the upcoming year. End of quote. Unlike stocks, the bond market reflects the true condition of the economy. 2-year treasuries are at historic lows, while the 10-year has dipped below 3%. The flight to safety is pushing bond yields down, even while equities continue to surge. Deflationary pressures are building. Bondholders are not taken in by the cheery news of green shoots. They know how to read the data. Spending is down. Credit is tight. Unemployment is headed higher. The banks are hiding their red ink. Europe's in trouble. Manufacturing is about to slide. Housing is in free fall. The money supply is shrinking. And the Fed is sitting on its hands doing nothing. When industry leader Procter & Gamble missed analysts' estimates on Tuesday, it became clear that product prices would be slashed in an effort to retain market share. When prices fall, inventories are reduced and workers are laid off. That's how the downward spiral begins. The next leg down will be falling wages and collapsing asset prices. That also will increase unemployment and put more pressure on bank balance sheets, lending to another round of bank closures. Here's an excerpt from the New York Times, and I quote, "Pay cuts are appearing most frequently among state and local governments, which are under extraordinary budget pressures and have often already tried furloughs, i.e. docking pay in exchange for time off. Small businesses are also cutting workers' pay, often to help stay afloat or to eliminate their losses. Although a few have seized on the slack labor market and workers' weak bargaining power to cut pay and thereby increase their profits and competitiveness." All right, ladies and gentlemen, I will give you, without further ado, my information. The toll-free number, as always, to call in with your questions, rents questions, and other forms of communication is 888-874-4888. You might want to take this down. You might want to use the number. You never know. It is 888-874-4888. If you would like to email in your questions or other forms of communication, as opposed to calling them in, you may email them to me. My email is constantly open, and if it comes in, I shall take it immediately as a priority. Your emails are very important to me, ladies and gentlemen, and you should write to me at rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, RM@GFAWD.com. And as always, if you would like to call me, you may do so at a number which is my direct line into Singapore via Sarasota. Your financial obligation ends in Sarasota, where ours picks up. And the number you would want to call is 941 area code 441-1682. That's my direct line to call me anytime, except, of course, during the show. And if you do happen to find the number doesn't answer or it's busy, leave a message with your phone number and I will call you back. Once again, the number to call for your personal questions and help with your financial situation, in as much as I can give it, is 941-441-1682. All right, well, just to put things into perspective, which I would hope that by now they pretty much are, but I came across these rather curious and rather alarming statistics, which I thought you should be aware of. Consider the odds of seeing the following. It is a 1 in 20 event to see successive declines in durable goods shipments and orders, such as we have been seeing. To see the CPI, that's the Consumer Price Index, to see the CPI down for 3 months in a row is a 1 in 40 event. And that's, of course, needless to say, what we have been seeing. To see the PPI falling 3 months in a row, the PPI being the Producer Price Index, to see the PPI falling 3 months in a row carries 1 in 25 odds. But to have both PPI and CPI fall 3 months in a row is a 1 in 85 event. As for retail sales, posting back-to-back declines during expansionary periods is a 1 in 35 event. As for deflationary waves hitting the shores of the labor market, a decline in average hourly earnings, as we saw in last month's payroll data, is a 1 in 50 event. And yet, despite all this, ladies and gentlemen, Wall Street economists and strategists are busy telling us how normal things are. Well, if you haven't understood by now how much harm the media are doing, and the media actually seem to try to do with their misinformation, then I guess it'll be very hard to convince you. Well, although there is some debate about the difference between a depression and a recession, history suggests a depression tends to have a lasting impact on attitudes and behavior, while the effects of a recession are temporary. For the most part, the recessions that took place during the two decades or so prior to the downturn that began in December 2007 didn't really alter the free spending ways of the American consumer. Once the hardest times had passed, Americans were quick to resume their old habits. However, as Robert Samuelson notes in a Newsweek commentary entitled "Insecurity Goes Upscale," fallout this time has been dramatic and far-reaching. How the recession has changed us. It has been the most egalitarian of all the 11 recessions since World War II. In various ways, it has touched every social class through job loss, pay cuts, depressed home values, shrunken stock portfolios, eroded retirement savings, grown children turning home, and anxiety about all of those. The Great Recession, as it's widely called, has changed America psychologically, politically, economically, and socially. Just how will be examined and debated for years. Here comes a booming cottage industry of scholars, pollsters, and pundits. A new study from the Pew Research Center, based on an opinion survey in May of nearly 3,000 Americans and an exhaustive evaluation of economic data, provides a preview. Not surprisingly, it confirms that Americans have become more frugal. 71% say they are buying less expensive brands. 57% say they've trimmed or eliminated vacations. Life plans have changed. 11% say they've postponed marriage or children, while 9% have moved in with parents. Previous recessions have focused their hurt on the young and unskilled. This remains true. Almost one-fifth of workers, 16 to 24, were unemployed at the end of 2009, a near doubling since late 2007. Among those without a high school diploma, joblessness was 50% higher than the average. Still, the economic and spiritual damage extends much further for many reasons. According to Samuelson, the key factors include a very large number of job losses, widespread pay cuts, and a substantial decline in housing and stock market wealth. That said, the pain has not been evenly felt. One paradox identified by Pew is that some groups that, quote, have been hardest hit by this recession, including blacks, young adults, and Democrats, are significantly more upbeat than their more sheltered counterparts, including whites, older adults, and Republicans, about a recovery, end of quote. For instance, blacks suffer much higher unemployment than whites, 15.4% versus 8.6% in June, but believe more strongly than whites that recovery has begun, 47% to 38%. Pew's explanation for this is politics. With a Democratic administration, Democrats are more upbeat and Republicans are more glum. Another theory, more powerful, I think, is that the Great Recession, though jarring to almost everyone, was most destructive and disillusioning to those who previously were the most protected. It punctured their cocoons so unexpectedly that they became more cautious and fearful, whereas those who even in good times faced job loss and income shifts, mainly blacks, the young, and the poor, were less surprised and affected. One legacy of the Great Recession is that insecurity and uncertainty have gone up scale. People feel more exposed. They tend to plan for the worst rather than hope for the best. Their reluctance to make major purchase commitments, a new car or home, validates their pessimism by retarding recovery. While Samuelson doesn't go as far as to label it as such, it sure sounds like a kind of sea change that characterizes a depression. All right, we have Creighton in New York City who would like to talk about goals and why people are hedging their bets with precious metals. Hello, Creighton. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
I'm sorry to take so long to get back to you. What can I do for you, Creighton? Let's hear your question.
I just noticed that people keep saying because of they keep betting that there's going to be inflation because of the overprinting of money. And then they're saying, well, since potentially the dollar could go down, why not just, they're equating gold with money. And I'm just wondering, why does this continue to go on? Isn't this a huge bubble?
Why does what continue to go on exactly, Creighton?
This consistently promoting, you hear it all over the television, the radio, about buying gold. And I've heard your take on it before. I'm just wondering why you think it consistently goes on and what the repercussions possibly could be.
Well, one of the major reasons I've always thought that people get bombarded with this gold question is because there are so many companies who specialize in selling gold. I mean,
I don't know if you also heard, too, recently they're putting taxes on buying bullion as well. So it's like I don't even see the benefit because of the taxes as well. You hear
that? The tax is huge. I mean, the gold is considered a collectible, so the taxes, I think, are something like 27% on the profits. But
right.
To answer your question, the gold community is very powerful. They have a very well-funded base, and the gold companies, let's say companies which specialize in selling gold to the community, are almost like an ongoing infomercial. If you think of other
essentially are just people being suckered again. They were suckered into tech stocks, suckered into real estate, and now it's gold.
Yeah, that's really how I would see it. I mean, but they're very well organized, these gold people. You know, they're very well financed. A lot of them are signed up with gold mines. So, for a penny a piece, you can go out there and get all kinds of information about gold mining investments, gold bullion investments. people, you know, selling gold as money, which of course it is not. Whatever you want to say about gold, it is not money. And don't let anybody confuse you in that respect.
They make it kind of seem like it'll wind up being like a situation in Argentina that one day we'll wake up and the dollar will be so devalued that if you didn't have your money diversified in gold or real estate, that your savings will be gone. I mean, that's the fear that they're trying to instill in people, it seems to me.
But don't forget, in Argentina, gold was only one asset that you could have purchased in order to avoid the decline of the peso. When the peso lost a third of its value in 24 hours in Argentina, all you had to hold was dollars. You could have held dollars or gold or, as you say, real estate or any other currency. You didn't just have to hold gold. So it's misleading. It's misleading to cite gold as the panacea for all that's wrong in the world. There is no basic precedent for this. You see, because every time this had ever happened in the past, gold was on the currencies were on the gold standard. Major currencies were on the gold standard. So you didn't really know what gold was going to do. But interestingly enough, we do have the case of silver. And silver lost 75% of its value during the deflationary depression of 1929-1930. So viewed from that perspective, I think it's instructive to see what potentially could happen to gold. And you see, the problem with gold that I have is that so many people that hold gold are going to have to basically sell their gold in order to pay off their debts. And so there is absolutely no reason at all why the price of gold shouldn't fall, as I keep saying, and the value of gold rise at the same time, simultaneously, the value of gold rising against the currencies or other assets. Other assets. The price of gold against other currencies can fall. But it can rise in value against other commodities and other assets of one sort or another, including real estate. Clayton, I'm sorry that you cut out. If you want to call back or can call back, we can continue the conversation. I'm told that your phone sort of cut out. I don't know whether you were on a cell phone or whether it was our fault or what happened, but it was interesting talking to you, and I'm really sorry that you cut out. And in fact, what we're going to do, I think, at this point, is we'll take a break. And Creighton, if you want to call back in, please feel free to do so. We'll continue the conversation. Otherwise, I shall talk to you about the Federal Reserve. I have some more to say about that, and we've talked about it in the past. And I think it's time we had another little chat about the Fed. So after our break, which we shall take right now, I shall come back. And we will wade straight in either to Creighton's continued question or to a discussion about the Fed.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Stephen Lindman hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour, Saturdays and Sundays, as well as currently on Thursdays, as an antidote to government and corporate propaganda on the most cutting-edge world and national topics. Distinguished guests are regularly featured to provide commentary and analysis impossible to the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation and what Project Censored calls junk food news. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Progressives, this is Betsy Rosenberg on the Green Front. I hope you've been enjoying the news I'm bringing you hot off the press, so to speak, like behind-the-scenes stories and insider scoop from Al Gore's recent climate conference. I know the Greenistas and love introducing the most informative and inspiring experts on the Green Front every week. So join me as we learn more about our environment and what we can do to turn it around.
The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
All right, we're back. It was interesting music. Well, I think it's time to talk about the Fed. Well, I actually probably should have done this at the beginning of the show because I like to leave all the heavy stuff at the beginning and then try to taper off, especially at the end of what must be a very tying and taxing week for you all. But the time has come, ladies and gentlemen, and we need to talk about the Fed, because the Fed is causing too much trouble and is contributing too much to the collapse and the destruction of the country. We can't just leave it alone. We have to discuss it and understand it, especially as millions of Americans are really now waking up to the fact that the Federal Reserve is bad. The trouble is very few people can coherently explain why this is true. You see, for decades, an unelected, privately owned central bank has controlled America's currency, run your economy, and basically driven the U.S. government to the brink of bankruptcy. The Fed operates in great secrecy. It's never been subjected to a comprehensive audit, and yet the actions it takes have an impact on every single American. It is an institution designed to drain wealth from the U.S. government, and ultimately from the American people, and transfer it to the ultra-wealthy. Have you ever wondered why a sovereign nation such as the United States has to borrow United States dollars from anyone? Have you ever wondered why a sovereign nation such as the United States doesn't even issue its own currency? Have you ever wondered why we allow a group of unelected private bankers to run the economy? These are some very important questions. And hopefully what I am about to tell you will open the eyes of many of you. Because you see, the truth is that the financial system is centrally controlled and centrally managed by a group of banking oligarchs who constructed an ever-expanding debt spiral which has been efficiently designed to transfer all wealth into their hands slowly but surely. So here's why the Federal Reserve is not good for the United States. The Federal Reserve was created as a way to enslave the U.S. government with debt. The truth is that the U.S. government only goes into debt if it chooses to.
theoretically, one day, that U.S. government could simply decide to print as many dollars as it wants to pay off all government debts. But under the current system, that is not allowed. You see, today the U.S. government doesn't issue any money. The Federal Reserve issues all money. That's why they are called Federal Reserve notes. Under the current regime, whenever the U.S. government wants more currency to be created, it has to go into more debt. If you will take out a dollar bill and have a look at it, you will notice that it says Federal Reserve Note at the top. It belongs to the Federal Reserve. The U.S. government cannot simply go out and create new money whenever it wants under the current system. Instead, it must get it from the Federal Reserve. So when the U.S. government needs to borrow more money, which happens quite a lot these days, you may have noticed, it goes over to the Federal Reserve and asks them for some more green pieces of paper called Federal Reserve notes. The Federal Reserve swaps these green pieces for pink pieces of paper called U.S. Treasury bonds. The Federal Reserve either sells these U.S. Treasury bonds or they keep the bonds for themselves, which also happens quite a lot these days. So that's how the U.S. government gets more green pieces of paper called U.S. dollars to put into circulation. But by doing so, they get themselves into even more debt, which they will owe even more interest on. So every time the U.S. government does this, the national debt gets even bigger, and the interest on that debt gets even bigger. Now, apologists for the Federal Reserve system are quick to point out that the Federal Reserve doesn't make much of a profit. Once a statute dividend of 6% is paid to member banks and a capital account surplus is maintained, the rest of the profits of the Federal Reserve go back to the U.S. Treasury. Unfortunately, that doesn't solve the problem. The point is not how much of a profit the Federal Reserve makes or doesn't make. The point is that the Federal Reserve is a tool for creating U.S. government debt, which slowly drains American national wealth and which ends up greatly enriching the global elite. As of July the 1st, the U.S. government had spent $355 billion so far in 2010 on interest payments to the holders of the national debt. Have you ever wondered who gets all that money? The truth is that the wealthiest individuals around the globe have been getting very rich for a very long time from U.S. government debt. The Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air. This fact constantly comes out in congressional hearings, and yet the American people just don't seem to get too upset about it. During a recent Joint Economic Committee hearing on Capitol Hill, U.S. Representative Ron Paul directly confronted Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke about this $1.3 trillion. As Ron Paul described how this $1.3 trillion was created just out of thin air, all Bernanke could do was nod his head. Why? Because it was the truth. The huge predator megabanks that now dominate the U.S. banking system use the Federal Reserve as a tool to make money. One of the ways they do this is called the U.S. Treasury carry trade. What happens is that the Federal Reserve lends huge amounts of money to the megabanks for next to nothing, and then these megabanks use all that cash to buy U.S. government debt. This little trick helped enable four of the biggest U.S. banks, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, to have a perfect quarter with 0 days of trading losses during the first quarter of 2010. Wouldn't you like to have a perfect batting average? The Federal Reserve devalues the currency. Since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, the U.S. dollar has lost 96% of its purchasing power.
The truth is just a 2% inflation rate will wipe out half of your purchasing power within a single generation. If you could look at a chart of inflation dating back 200 years, you would clearly see that the beginning of the rapid rise of inflation in the United States coincided with the creation of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve manipulates the U.S. economy by setting national interest rates. By keeping rates high or low, the Federal Reserve has the power to create economic growth or to destroy it. They have the power to inflate massive bubbles and to pop them. Most Americans give way too much credit and blame to presidents like Bush or Obama for how the economy is doing. The truth is that they really don't have that much control over the economy compared to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve also controls the national money supply. They can pump trillions into the economy or pull trillions out without being accountable to anyone. This can have disastrous consequences. For example, after the U.S. stock market crash of 1929, the Federal Reserve continued to contract the money supply. Many analysts believe that this is one of the key things that precipitated the Great Depression. The Federal Reserve is not part of the U.S. government. The truth is that the Federal Reserve is about as Federal Express. In defending itself against a Bloomberg request for information under the Freedom of Information Act, the Federal Reserve objected by declaring that it was not an agency of the U.S. government, and therefore it was not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. It's kind of funny how Fed officials are always talking about how important their independence is. But whenever anyone starts criticizing them for being private, they start stressing their ties with the government. The Federal Reserve has become far, far too powerful. The reality is that those running the Federal Reserve are not elected and yet have an enormous amount of control. In fact, Ron Paul recently told MSNBC that he believes that the Federal Reserve is more powerful than Congress. The Federal Reserve is dominated by Wall Street and the New York banks. The New York representative is the only permanent member of the Federal Open Market Committee, while other regional banks rotate in 2 and 3 year intervals. The former head of the New York Federal Reserve, Timothy Geithner, is now U.S. Treasury Secretary. The truth is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has always been the most important of the regional Fed banks by far, and in turn, the Federal Bank of New York has always been dominated by Wall Street and the major New York banks. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke wants to eliminate completely the minimum reserve requirements for banks. Fractional reserve banking has always been the way that the bankers have conned the public, but now Bernanke wants to get rid of the pretense of reserves altogether. It is almost too bizarre to believe, but it is right there in black and white on the Federal Reserve's own website. And I quote, "The Federal Reserve believes it possible that ultimately its operating framework will allow the elimination of minimum reserve requirements which impose costs and distortions on the banking system." End of quote. The Federal Reserve is not accountable to anyone. The Federal Reserve has never undergone a true comprehensive audit since it was created back in 1913. Ron Paul's proposal to audit the Federal Reserve, which had previously been co-sponsored by 320 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, ultimately failed by a vote of 229 to 198. The American people should be able to see what is going on inside the Federal Reserve. They should have some way to keep them accountable. After all, they have an incredible amount of power over the people. Shouldn't the people have at least a little bit of power over them? Unfortunately, the truth is that they desperately do not want light to be shone on the elaborate shell game that they are running.
Have you ever wondered if it was just a coincidence that the personal income tax was implemented just about exactly the same time that the Federal Reserve was created? Why does the U.S. government have to tax the people? The point is that the U.S. government should not have to get U.S. dollars from someone else. If you take a few minutes to stop and think about it, an America where there is no Federal Reserve, no personal income tax, and no IRS is not that hard to imagine. The U.S. government functioned just fine without all of them at one time. There's no reason why it couldn't function just fine without all of them now. The system in place right now clearly is not working. The Federal Reserve was supposed to guarantee that the financial system would be perfectly stable, but in reality, the financial system has become much more unstable. It's time for different thinking. It's time for the U.S. government to take back control of your currency and your economy. This is what the Constitution provided for. It is time to start electing people with common sense to represent you in Washington. Well, I get an email in from Al Berry who says, "Dear Richard, if you get rid of the Federal Reserve, you've done nothing if you do not get rid of fractional reserve banking. What is your opinion?" Thank you, Al Berry. Well, basically, fractional reserve banking, and I'm sure many of you are not really familiar with what it is, and I will discuss it at a future date. I did used to talk about it quite a lot years ago when I started out with the wake-up call, but I guess many of you are new since then. Federal Reserve banking just basically allows for a bank to receive a dollar from the Fed and to lend out X amount of percentage times that dollar, which we'll say, for example, is 10%, which means that they may lend out $90 for every $10 that they receive from the Fed. It's just money spun out of thin air. And in reply to your question, Al, if the banks don't receive money from a central bank, then clearly there is no mandate for a fractional reserve bank lending system, because they haven't borrowed money from anybody. See, there's no reason why banks should borrow money from a central bank. It's all your money, ladies and gentlemen. There's no reason why other people, other banks, should have to borrow that money. The money, if it is printed, should be printed directly in line with what you, the public, need, and you should receive that money. The idea that there is an intermediary in the form of a bank that borrows it from a central bank is simply a disguised way of making profits for the bank. They're free profits, because all they have to do is to borrow the money from the Fed at a certain small rate of interest, turn around and lend it to you at a higher rate of interest, and hey, bingo, there's their profit right there on the table. That shouldn't happen, Al, and it wouldn't happen if there was no Federal Reserve. Hope that's answered your question. I hope that was your question. Okay, another question came in from Vandy Williams, who says, "Sir, one of our House members in the U.S. government created a bill to audit the Fed. My question is, would it not be more valuable to nationalize the Fed and, or if it is possible, to tax the Federal Reserve? Thank you. Very informative show." Well, thank you, Vandy. Your question, if you will forgive me for saying so, is self-defeating, because all you need to do is to delete the Federal Reserve in the first place. If you didn't have a Fed, you wouldn't have anything to audit. And if you didn't have the Fed, there would be nothing to nationalize. And if you didn't have the Fed, there would be nothing to tax. So that takes care of all your questions in one fell swoop. Get rid of the Fed. It's as easy as that. I hope that answers your question. It seems too easy for me. It seems
I should have more to have to say about this, but I don't. Sorry, Sandy. So actually, all roads lead to the elimination of the Fed. Now, there have been two central banks in the United States history, both of which have been disbanded in nominee through either scandals or incompetence or both. I am quite certain that the Fed will be disbanded at one point. Quite certain. The Fed will become disparaged, degraded, and finally the calls for its disbandment will be overwhelming, and Congress will correctly eliminate the Fed and take over the running of the money through the Treasury Department, as was provided for, as I said earlier on, by the Constitution. All right, well, here's another example of how you're being lied to and given the runaround by the media. You may have heard recently that U.S. companies have emerged from the financial crisis in robust health, that they've reported record profits, that they've paid down their debts, that they've rebuilt their balance sheets, and that they're sitting on growing piles of cash, and now they're ready to invest in the economy. Well, a look at the facts shows that companies only have record amounts of cash in the way that subprime Susie was flush with cash after the big refi back in 2005. You see, so long as you don't look at the liabilities, the picture looks great. According to the Federal Reserve, non-financial firms borrowed another $289 billion in the first quarter, taking their total domestic debts to $7.2 trillion. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that right. $7.2 trillion is the total domestic debts of the non-financial firms. The highest level ever by far. And that, by the way, is up by $1.1 trillion since the first quarter of 2007. It's twice the level seen in the late 1990s. The debt repayments made during the financial crisis were brief and minimal, tiny amounts totaling about $100 billion in the second and fourth quarters of 2009. Now, remember that these are the debts of non-financials, the part of the economy that's supposed to be in better shape. The banks, everyone knows, half of them are the walking dead. Hey, you give me, $1.1 trillion, and I'll show you a few profits. I'll show you some robust health. I'll pay down all the debts you want. Give me $1.1 trillion. I'll rebuild the balance sheet. And there's nothing I can't do. I'll show you a really good time with $1.1 trillion. And yet there's the media and the government and all the pundits and the powers that be telling you that everybody's doing great, that the financial crisis is over, record profit. Please give me a break. Just lies and lies and prevarications, day in, day out, week in, week out. And that's the limit that I could do, ladies and gentlemen, to keep you away from this stuff. I mean, I can't keep up. It goes on and on and on. I open up my email day after day, more and more scandals. Every day a new financial scandal is uncovered. Most people, interestingly enough, talking about the Great Depression, most people believe the economy crashed between 1929 and 32 and then remained depressed until the Second World War, which finally mobilized the economy's idle resources and brought about a full recovery. Well, that's complete nonsense. If you calculate the unemployment data correctly, even leaving aside the unemployment calculations, it's abundantly clear that once the Great Depression hit bottom in early 1933, the U.S. economy embarked on 4 years of expansion that constituted the biggest cyclical boom in U.S. economic history. I bet you didn't know that. But it's true, and that's why the stock market bottomed out in 1932. It bottomed at 40 in the Dow Jones. It never looked back.
Did you know that there was a boom, the largest cyclical boom in U.S. economic history between 1933 and 1937? For 4 years, real GDP grew at a 12% rate and nominal GDP grew at a 14% rate. Now, there was another shorter and shallower depression in 1937, largely caused by renewed fiscal tightening and higher Federal Reserve margin requirements, but this second depression has led to the misconception that the central bank was pushing on a string throughout all of the 1930s until the giant fiscal stimulus of the wartime effort finally brought the economy out of depression. That's incorrect. The financial dynamics of the huge economic recovery between 1933 and 37 are extremely striking. One of the reasons that you don't hear about this is because everybody talks up the great economic and social advantage of the New Deal that FDR created in 1932 and 33, right at the bottom of the Depression. It was completely unnecessary, ladies and gentlemen. It achieved nothing. Socially, it achieved, I guess, 80 years of borrowed time, as anybody could have seen on an actuarial basis if they had bothered to do the mathematical calculations when Social Security came into being, that it couldn't possibly work over time, along with the other egregious nonsense that FDR created and called the New Deal. Basically keeping prices high and basically keeping people in unwarranted poverty during all that time. Because that's really what happened. The boom didn't hit the lowest echelons of the economy. And that's why it seemed like there was an ongoing depression. It didn't happen that way. And if FDR, and indeed Herbert Hoover before him, had simply left the economy alone, that boom between 1933 and 1937 would have touched every layer of the economy and nobody would even have remembered a recession to this day. And this is not something you will ever read about in the history books and nobody will ever tell you this, but it happens to be true. You know, despite the insistence of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, the changes in the stock of money were behind all the cyclical ups and downs in U.S. economic history. Even they conceded that the monetary aggregates did not lead the U.S. economy out of the Depression in 1932-33. They had a recession in 1921 which was much more severe than the recession of 1930. But the terrifying thing is that what they did in 1930, they are doing today. The exact same thing, except 1,000 times worse, and the background is 1,000 times worse because the debt situation did not even exist. It isn't worse than in the 1930s. It didn't exist in the 1930s. The U.S. was a creditor nation. So what we are about to see boggles the mind. The imagination simply could not cope with the devastation and the financial Armageddon that we are about to experience, ladies and gentlemen. There is nothing remotely in a historical context which allows us to key off and to extrapolate what we are going to be seeing as time goes by. The horror is simply unthinkable. And I don't exaggerate. I do my best in these shows to give you chapter and verse, to give you statistics, figures, to do what I can to indicate how terrible things are going to get. A few anecdotes here and there, a few stories, some statistics, a little bit of education, like we talked about the Federal Reserve today, and of course answering all your questions, which, as I've always said, is the most important part of what I do here in my estimation.
See, it's not a question of moving to another corner of the United States. What you are seeing today, the beginnings of social unrest, violence, the increased bankruptcies that are being now reported, the housing situation, which is intolerable. In fact, I'll be sending out later on today some weekend reading for my email distribution list with a very in-depth look at housing. And when you've gone, those of you who subscribe to that, once you've been through that, I assure you, you will not want to buy a house again in your lifetimes. It's quite stunning. And this is not clairvoyance, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the people keep saying to me, how can you see these things in advance? It's nothing to do with clairvoyance. It is an application of mathematical standards, which are anathema to the powers that be in the media, all these people who lie to you, who give you the runaround. You will not get any useful information from these people. Stop looking for it. Please read about, you know, the Hilton sisters, the people who go to jail for 90 days and are released after 12 days because they're famous and rich and wealthy. You know, read about them instead. Get yourself some entertainment, but do not read about economic statistics and opinions and analysis from the mainstream press. You will only get yourselves into trouble. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I haven't managed to get to much by way of questions today, and I'm sorry about that. Apparently, Chelsea Clinton's wedding to investment banker Mark Mezvinsky cost Papa Bill $3 million. And according to the London Daily Mail, the total price tag will be about $5 million. The additional $2 million apparently is being laid off on U.S. taxpayers, as usual, with the Secret Service costs for protecting the former president and the foreign heads of state, such as the presidents of France and Italy and the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and the 500 invited guests, along with Barbara Streisand, Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, Ted Turner, and, of course, Clinton friend and donor Denise Rich, the wife of the Clinton pardoned felon. Well, thank you so much. How nice. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, it remains for me to wish you a wonderful weekend. I hope you're getting some good weather over there. At least our weather seems to be improving somewhat over here. So one way or another, I will be back with you, as always, on Monday morning at 10 a.m. sharp Eastern time. So until then, have a wonderful weekend. I'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.